will, he said. In unity we prevail. In conflict we falter. Let us take the fight to the enemy with our blades held as brothers, and refrain from further discord. Neither Garadan nor Moloch openly demurred, but both continued to glare at one another. At least, I could see the hostility in Garadan's expression. Moloch was like a graven image, implacable and unmoving, his bronze visage inscribed only with its runes of destruction. "To prevent the misunderstandings that have plagued us," Valoris went on, "we must learn to speak to one another. I nominate Shield Captain Urnus as my intermediary delegate. One member of each chapter of the Adeptus Astartes here present shall also be nominated. The Council shall act as our clearinghouse. Chancellor, I trust you are able to act in this regard."
Jack stood and bowed.
"It shall be my honour, Lord," she said.
Like a Shariel before her, she did not seem much daunted by the titans of battle around her. Exhausted or not, I was impressed by her bearing, and I resolved to speak to her after the session concluded. In the event, once the last business had been attended to and the Space Marines had lumbered off under the watchful gaze of the tower's guards, I did not have to seek her. She came to find me.
"Shield Captain Valerian," she said, bowing. "You may not remember me, but..."
"I remember you perfectly, Chancellor," I said. "My congratulations on your appointment. A trying time to take the office. I trust that you are sustained by His Grace."
She looked surprised and pleased by those words. I did not understand why. Once again, I regretted my inability to fully comprehend the strange ways of baseline humanity. By then, the High Lords were making their way from the chamber, followed by their trains of menials. Valoris was deep in conversation with Urnus, and the others of my order were also making their way to rejoin their various detachments.
"This peace will not last," she told me, her voice low. "I saw your communiques. You know this too."
"We must make it last," I said.
"I will do what I can," she said. "But understand this. The Council has not met. No formal summons to the Minotaurs was ever made. Either they are acting for their own purposes, or an individual with the power, working without consultation, has brought them back."
"They claim to have come by their own volition."
"So they do."
None of this was news to me. I appreciated her concern over the matter, but I was restricted in what I could say in response. Valoris seemed to have taken Moloch at his word, no doubt to maintain the fragile peace, and I could hardly gainsay that policy. We were all dancing around the core, spinning fictions to avoid confronting the unpalatable truth.
"But that is not all, is it?" I asked.
She drew closer.
"They do not meet because they cannot. Trust has gone. There is no leader. That is the real danger. You, I believe, understand how things are. Feel free, should you wish it, to call on me. We worked together before. When our masters do not act with resolution, sometimes I believe it is for their servants to take the initiative. Do you agree?"
That was bold.
Valoris was still in the chamber, and the High Lords had only just left. I doubted she wished for an actual statement of alliance from me, but I saw the risk she had run by making her own position clear, and did not wish to discourage her. I found the gesture reassuring, in truth, a sign that there were others in the Senatorum who saw the dangers in lassitude. I reached for a secure combead and gave it to her.
"He protects the courageous," I told her.
"Let us stay in touch."
Chapter 18. Alea. I made planetfall again, far sooner than I had ever hoped for. I made myself watch through the real viewers on the way down, gazing at the vomit-grey clouds as they swirled and eddied across the atmosphere. The sight had lost none of its power to repulse me. It had always been fanciful to think that I had escaped. Luna had been a staging post, to be sure, but one too close to its mistress world, too interlocked with its ancient feuds and politics. So I was falling back into the Terran gravity well again, dragged down as surely as if a fist had clamped around my hair and hold me there. This time, however, I was not alone. Five of my sisters came with me, all of them armoured in the same manner and bearing the same pattern of great blades. Some differentiations within the sisterhood were starting to emerge in those days. I had called myself a witch-seeker when serving on a racer, and had used the term without much thought for whether it had any currency in other places. Now others had been given that title formally, forming cadres dedicated to hunting down the aberrant and the corrupted. Their weapon of choice was the flamer, all the better to cleanse the various cankers and perversions they sought out. Since arriving in the Sol system, however, I had taken up my great blade with enthusiasm, relishing the flamboyance of the weapon. Its rhythms and weight had fallen naturally into place around me, such that whenever I was without the Somnus blade for any length of time, I began to miss it. We called ourselves Vigilators, taking on the name as if it had been part of our lexicon for centuries. I do not know its original provenance, and suspect that the heritage was in actual fact not very extensive, but it helped the process of healing, to have these formal titles to use. So I was not cynical about it at all. I welcomed the term, and I felt no nostalgia for my old service as a witch-seeker. The new styling carried with it a whiff of vengeance, something that had become painfully appropriate. Within the sisterhood, the habit had also begun to spread of naming our cadres, to give them a unity and a sense of purpose. I was sure that we must have done similarly in the age of myth, and thus we were preserving our ancient custom. When I met my fellow vigilators for the first time, it did not take us long to determine that we wished to be known by a common name, something that would mark us and our mission out. One of our number, Tali Shah, gave us what we needed. "We are Revenants," she said, "back from the dead, bearing the old blades." Thus became the Revenant Blades, given the task not of hunting witches, but of running down those who hunted us. The enemy, whoever they were precisely, wished to make us ghosts again. Whatever else happened within the Regent's brave new world of reform and reconquest, we would ensure that never happened. "I do not know why or how your order was ever permitted to wither," he had told me. That had to be true. Such things had taken place long after his first departure from the throne world. He had known well enough, however, the risk of it occurring again. As our lander shook and shuddered on its final descent, I glanced around the crew bay. It was a small craft, commandeered from the Port Lunar Inventory over the protests of the Berth Governor, and we had suffered no others to come with us, no pilots, no overseers, no guards. Sister Rover sat in the cockpit at the controls, with Sister Govania beside her. Sister Tali Shah sat beside me, while Sisters Irinia and Lethiel sat opposite. We were as varied in appearance as any group taken from such diverse worlds would be. Irinia was thick-set and powerful, hailing from the high-grav planet of Ilion, and Govania was tall and slender, due to her upbringing on the old orbitals of Mogrengave. Rover's skin was ice-white, and her eyes were lilac, whereas Lethiel's complexion was almost as black as polished ebony. We had varying levels of experience and training, save for a shared proficiency with the Longblade, and markedly different thought-mark dialects. None of that mattered. We were entering what we all now regarded as hostile territory, a world riven with factional interest and battered by repeated waves of psionic disruption. That made us sisters, indeed, bound together by a shared enemy. Asurma had made arrangements for our re-entry at the Sisterhood's embassy tower within the palace. As it happened, our passage through orbital space was delayed due to the arrival in-system of dozens of Navy assault carriers, all of which required processing before being allowed to progress to wherever their drop sites were. I did not mind the delay. I was pleased to see some evidence of long-awaited reinforcements. Soon, though, we were plummeting into the atmosphere ourselves, driving a spear through the cloud cover and bursting out again on the underside, coursing with flame. As we slowed for landing, I saw once again the great world city yawn away below and around us, its profile broken by the colossal artificial mountains of the palace buildings. We did not tarry long, once grounded. We all had our targets, selected while still on Luna. We uttered a last vow of retribution, made arrangements for our reunion, then split up, disappearing into the sprawl and the clamour like the ghosts we had named ourselves after. I myself did not travel far. I had already determined who I needed to speak to, and felt a mix of resentment and anticipation at the choice. Anticipation because I had often thought of him while on Luna. You did not face death with a fellow warrior only to forget him when fate pulls you apart, and wish to know how he was faring. Resentment, because I was coming to him because I needed him. He was, as he had so often told me, a scholar, one who had studied the past as completely as he studied the present. My questions would have answers, I felt sure, in the many libraries and repositories of this world. But it would be swifter to go to a soul who took pleasure in unearthing secrets. Were they the only reasons? Did I feel the need for that uncomplicated friendship again, perhaps amid all the treachery and disappointment? Maybe, but such non-warlike things were not my province. His, neither. We had learned to kill so swiftly, and yet we were so poor at doing the things that unaltered humans did naturally. I had no soul, he had no spirit. We made a natural enough pair, I suppose. My status gained me rapid access to the Tower of Hegemon, that mournful citadel they had occupied since the dawn of known history. As I walked through its solid corridors, austere and yet so perfectly constructed, I tried not to make the comparisons I had done on my first visit, and held my jealousy in check for a time when it might be of more use. I was lucky to find him there at all, at least, that is, if you believe in luck. They told me he had been recently called in for a hastily convened summit of lords and generals, and would soon be heading back out on operations with his brothers. I pictured him for a moment, sitting at a golden table surrounded by golden armoured counsellors, sagely debating the needs of the age, and thought that the image suited him. But when I finally met him in person again, within far less exalted chambers, I was surprised to see the change. Not physically, of course, he was as immaculate as ever, but in the way he carried himself. It was hard to pinpoint exactly what that meant, but I detected something almost ineffable, an impatience, perhaps, a desire that had simply not been there before. Maybe I was looking for something that wasn't present, or maybe he had indeed been changed, either by what we had both experienced, or by something since. "Tanal," Valerian said, greeting me with what seemed like unfeigned pleasure. Then, just as he had always done, he lapsed into faultless thought-mark. "You carry the great blade. Good. It always suited you." We did not waste much time on pleasantries. We were both incapable of that, so wedded to our objectives and our tasks. To any normal witness, had one been there, we must have seemed absurd, making up for our deficiencies through formality. "We were attacked," I told him. "They almost succeeded. History is repeating itself. Someone wants us gone." He had the decency to be shocked, which gratified me. I ran through the details of the lander and its contents, the circumstances of the attack, its results. "You have not been the only target," he signed back. "Many sites have been struck. What do you know of your attackers?" "Little enough. That is why I came to you." He leaned forward, earnestly searching for something to help me. "The principal symbol of the splintered is a broken diamond, but there are other sub-carders. I have been pursuing one with a teardrop icon. Perhaps... I interrupted him. Nothing like that, I signed. They wished us to doubt our own kind. I do not believe it was one of the cults you hunt, either. The trail led back here.
Can you be sure?
The cabals are capable and well-resourced. They are also wholly corrupted and would no doubt wish your kind harm. We were hardly unprotected from such wretches, I told him. Whoever did this was able to work through Terran channels. That is also the reason it cannot be the Fellowship, despite the appearance they work to cultivate. He looked uncertain.
The Fellowship?
I told him of my researches on Luna. I told him of the nature of the Citadel, the night-grey hinterland of beggars, riddles and witches, and the nature of our servants. They were once, so they say, of the Sol Knight, I told him.
Selenite,
he corrected. I raised an eyebrow.
A distortion of an old name,
he signed.
The Selenites were powerful. I know little more than the word, and the records are lost, but they were the original occupants of Somnus.
And no one thought to inform me of this before I left, I signed sourly.
My door was always open,
he replied. That was a subtle cut, though delivered in all innocence. He was right, of course. I should not have waited so long to see him again.
The Selenites were the gene cults of the old knight,
he went on.
Masters of creation and flesh change. The Emperor defeated them, we are told, and drove them into oblivion. Their false arts were expunged from history and replaced with his greater science. That was perhaps the origin of this woman's song, a distant memory of an old and justified purge.
The weavers of fates, the makers of the greater flesh, I signed, repeating to him what she had told me. She said they had spun for the other king. She said they had worked for him.
As I said, Valerian replied confidently. Old stories, old distortions.
But then at some stage we arrived, I signed. We took up residence and the Fellowship swapped matriarchs for queens.
So a Selenite remnant would have every reason to hate you.
If any still existed, I signed. What lingers is a half-memory, a set of dregs clinging on to the edge of extinction. He nodded.
By the sounds of it, you do not suspect them.
I suspect the ones who drove us out before. I suspect those who cannot abide our existence as a matter of faith. I suspect the Church. He thought on that.
The Ecclesiarchy has been in some turmoil, he signed, as all things have here.
Someone within it, then, I replied. A renegade, perhaps. Some fanatic who hates what we are.
Or maybe not. They teach the salvation of souls, gathered to the bosom of the Emperor in death. We have no souls, therefore we can have no salvation. I am glad, he signed, suddenly apropos of very little we were debating at the time, that you were preserved.
Despite myself, I couldn't help the twitch of a smile. The expression of it was so characteristically clumsy. As was I told him. But someone down here is not.
You have proof, I presume, he said.
I shook my head. Nothing concrete. But the one I tracked was an Ecclesiarchy agent, I am convinced. It was near the end of the trail. They were cleaning up, killing or destroying evidence, and I caught him. He carried an auto-catechism, which had instructions intact. It was clumsy. He was remiss to have left them unencoded. I showed him facsimiles of the transmissions I had taken from the device. Most, of course, were mundane things and hardly pointed in any direction at all. I had placed my hopes on one reference. A name was repeated often. Peda. A surname? A code name? I hoped you might be able to assist. His handler, I assume,
someone senior, though I know nothing of the hierarchy here.
Valerian looked at it for a moment. He studied the context, the other messages, the encodings.
I do not believe this is a name. I think you were right. They were careless.
I was immediately irritated. What had he seen that I had not?
Tell me. The bureaucracy on Terra has its own idioms,
he signed,
used to abbreviate common references to the figures they are charged to deal with.
He indicated the end of the sequence and worked backwards.
Suppose you are correct that this agent was embedded within the Ministerium. The current ecclesiarch is Eos Ritera, brought from Ultramar by the Primarch. E.R. The next letters in line, E.D., are merely the High Gothic initials of her title, Excelsis Dominus, High Lord. But the ecclesiarch is one of the regent's appointees. She is of the reform tendency, wedded to Gilliman's changes, of which you are one of the most prominent. She would have opposed this with all her power.
Then what of the P?
Standard archive expression. That initial stands for prior. So if this logic is sound, the agent was using a shorthand for Ritterar's predecessor, exiled from the council by the Primarch's command. We may therefore make a supposition that the man identified here is Baldo Slist, the old ecclesiarch.
As he said the words, I felt a thrill run through me. It slotted into place. I sensed the rightness of it, just as a hunter always recognizes the scent of their quarry. And how, then, would I find this man?
Wait, Valerian protested. Wait a moment. What reason would he have? He no longer serves. Whoever did this took a big risk, and the gamble has failed to pay.
I shrugged.
He is bitter. He cannot let go of the past. He hates.
I leaned forward. Valerian knew so much in some ways, but he thought rationally in terms of gains and losses. A custodian might find it easy to forget that most of us were never rational, governed by baser instincts. Forget reasons. Think of what his life was, what he loathed, and what he venerated. Perhaps he cared nothing for the risk. Perhaps he just had to hurt us.
Valerian pondered that. Slist was of the static tendency, he mused,
almost reluctantly.
It may not have been you he wished to hurt. It may be the one who restored you.
He looked as if he were thinking hard then, making links to things I was not aware of.
They do not meet because there is no trust.
Now I was losing him. I itched to be moving, to track down this new lead. Valerian could ponder politics all he wished. I had a name, but not much else. How would I find this man? I asked him again, this time with a more forceful gesture lattice. Valerian looked up at me. I could tell his instinct was to hold back. But then again, he must have known I would find a way somehow. This thing had already started.
I can give you coordinates of his estates and private holdings, Valerian signed. He has been exiled from his command, but is otherwise unsanctioned. I assume he remains rich, with access to considerable security. If you choose to go after him, he will not be an easy quarry.
And no scrutiny is performed on him? No surveillance?
Of course there is. I would have to consult with the Chancellor to be accurate, but I believe that would come under the purview of the Grand Provost Marshal.
And what tendency would they be, in your view? Valerian hesitated a moment before replying.
Static.
I rose. Do not report this, I signed. He must not see us coming for him. I will rip the truth from him myself. Then I halted. But you could come with us, if you wished it. Hunt with me again, like we did before. I might have imagined it. I might have seen something that was not there. But I could swear that I saw a flash of yearning,
just for a moment. If his discipline had been less iron-hard, if he had not had to contend with every scrap of conditioning in his master-crafted body to stay wedded to his mission, I think he might have done it. After all, he had taken the chance once before, in a display of impetuosity that had genuinely shocked me, one that had led to many of the changes we now saw around us. But not this time. His composure returned. "I wish you success, sister," he signed. "I wish you to find your truth. As for myself, I remain bound by the commands of my captain." Was there some bitterness in his gestures there? "This is your quarry, and I am bound to pursue my own." I could hardly fault him. If anything surprised me, it was my regret at his swift decision. Perhaps the change I had perceived in him was of a more mundane sort, a reversion to type, and a withdrawal from what I thought he might become, given time. Disappointing, all the same. "Then I wish you success also." I made for the door. Just as I reached it, he came after me. He had taken his knife from his belt, the blade still in its gold-embroidered scabbard. As with everything he wore, it was superb. It was then that I knew I hadn't imagined it. He wished fervently to come with me, but was trapped by orders that he was virtually incapable, by design, of resisting. "Take this," he signed, then held it out. "A companion to the greater sword you carry." He looked at me intently. "I cannot be with you in person. A piece of me can go, though." I knew a little of the gift he offered me. His kind called it a misery cordia. It was longer than my combat blade, but not so much that it would hinder me. These were given to the custodians to mark their ascension into the ranks, and were objects of priceless worth. Its hilt was ornate, jewel-studded, and no doubt moulded to his unique grip. My gauntlet would look small against it, and yet there was no doubt that I could wield it. "Why?" I signed, reluctant to take it. It was such a strange gesture, so sudden and unasked for. In another soul I might have put it down to a burst of emotion, but this was Valerian, a being for whom emotion was something to be studied in others, its effects written calmly onto parchment, and the conclusions placed into learned institutions for long-term storage. "It is old," he signed. "It is from an age when your kind was still honoured. It may serve as reparation." And then he offered a half-smile, which flickered awkwardly across his features. "And you may need to kill a man. Best you do it with something worthy of the task." Remember I told you that we were poor at understanding kindness, so used were we to scorn. I was conscious of this as we spoke then. I was mindful that I found suspicion everywhere, and was almost unable to comprehend a situation in which a gesture might mean nothing other than its appearance, and be wholly genuine and without artifice. "Very well," I signed, taking the blade. "I shall endeavour to do it honour." And after that we had our purpose. We were not so foolish as to go after Slist immediately. As Valerian had intimated, he was still a powerful man, if only in riches and, that most valuable of commodities, influential friends. Instead, my sisters and I engaged in studies of our own, learning all we could about his movements, his associates, his habits and his vices. Gilliman's reforms to the council had been unusual in that the changes had not been accompanied by bloodshed or forcible removals. Many previous High Lords had left their office as corpses, whether through well-placed vials of poison in their fine suppers, or by failing to outrun old age and collapsing into their rejuve tanks. Others had been forced into exile proper, driven from terror and out into the distant and war-torn provinces. It was true that many others had been able to retire more gracefully and see out their final years in relative peace, but even in these cases, they had maintained private corps of security guards, and went watchfully, lest old vendettas catch up with them. The regent had disposed of his unwanted officials in a typically efficient manner. They had all been barred from returning to the great edifices of state, but were permitted to keep the bulk of their private estates intact and remain resident on Terra. No doubt that was how such things were done on Macrag, where, so I was told, administration was conducted along orderly lines and with a minimum of rancour. Here on Terra, such munificence smacked of naivety, though none would have dared say so out loud. Perhaps the Primarch was so secure in his grasp on power that he felt no need to provide absolute assurance that his deposed subordinates would ever come back to haunt him. Perhaps he trusted the institutions he had left behind to keep an adequate watch on them. Or perhaps, most scandalously of all, he actually trusted them to keep their word. Slist, we discovered, was not a man who had ever been liable to do that. He had been, by all accounts, one of the very most venal of the old High Lords. He had ruled the ecclesiarchy with a heavy hand, enforcing tithes on dioceses vigorously, and encouraging the more militant arms of his extensive fiefs to indulge their inclinations towards violent enforcement of ministerium dictates. He had been a close ally of the old master of the administratum, Irthu Himutalian, and together they had been responsible for the direction of events in the High Council over many decades. The Church and the administratum had always been close allies, sharing a similar institutional view on such feared human qualities as open-mindedness, innovation, or individuality. I could see why such a man would not have flourished in Gilliman's new dispensation, and I could see why he might have wished to remain active after his demotion. I could also see why he might pursue us on Luna. Along with the more active custodians and the still rare Primaris Space Marines, we were perhaps the most tangible sign of the new Imperium, a visible indication that things were in a state of development. Perhaps Slist could have lived with the first two of those reforms, since nothing in his sacred books said anything of either of them. But we, the soulless ones, the living refutations of the catechisms, the walking abominations who had been successfully purged in a healthier, stronger age, we were beyond contemplation. From what we could discover, he had retained a straggling network of apartments and fine houses, all within the walls of the inner palace, all guarded by scores of well-armed and well-paid militia. He had remained active and visible for some time after the events of the Great Rift, but had maintained a low profile after his demotion, moving location often, keeping out of the controversies that kept the official High Council busy. The more I studied him, the more I was convinced that Valerian's deduction was right, and that he had been behind the attack. He had the means, and he had the motive. Whether he was acting alone or had the help of others, I could not ascertain. All our efforts at that time were concentrated on finding him, and then figuring out a way to get to him. It soon became clear that a direct attempt to intercept him would be difficult. By then I had become convinced that he was no longer in the inner palace at all, but was elsewhere on the planet and acting through a web of intermediaries. He would have known well enough by now that the strike had failed, and would no doubt be taking precautions to cover his tracks. That presented us with a problem, for Terra was a big place, but also an opportunity. If he was on the move, for whatever reason, we might be able to reach him in transit. So we concentrated our efforts on the various staff of his many residences. We learned their names and followed them as they moved around the inner palace. One of them, a woman named Iritsa Castilian, soon became the focus of our work. She seemed almost as wealthy as he was and never travelled without a protective escort of bodyguards. She acted as some kind of major domo, overseeing the business of his properties, his staff and his remaining political affiliations. She was a large woman, given to wearing real velvet robes and heavy synthetic makeup. Like her master, her fingers seemed perpetually festooned with solid gold rings. Even if things had not been so personal for us, it would have been easy to hate her. The opportunity came soon enough.
We learned that she would be travelling from one of his estates, under the very shadow of the Senatorum, to a smaller villa near the inner walls. These were regions where the Lex had been fully restored, far from the ongoing unrest that we knew still gripped half the planet. She would be going by air, disembarking at a dedicated landing pad close to her destination and walking the remainder of the distance to the gates. This passage was short, less than 200 metres, along an internal corridor buried among a tangle of overlapping structures, but its obscurity made it ideal. We tracked her, Tali Shah tailing her flyer, the other four finding places to remain unseen along the processionary route. As for myself, I placed myself in full view, waiting for her out under the glare of the corridor's internal lumens. After a short wait, I received Tali Shah's warning and drew my new dagger. It was heavy in my grip, but less so than the Somnus blade. I decided that I already liked it. I heard the flyer come in, followed by the heavy slam of slide doors opening and closing. A little later, and Castilian emerged at the far end of the corridor. She was surrounded by 12 armed guards, all wearing close-fitting armour and helms and carrying lasguns. She saw me and froze. I made no move but stood facing her, alone. "Who are you?" she demanded. It would have been nice to have answered her, but of course I could not. I started to walk towards her, brandishing my blade openly. She panicked then, just as I had expected her to. Her guards opened fire. She attempted to shuffle back the way she had come. Of course, by then it was too late. I sprung into action, dancing my way through the lasbeams and piling into the guards, my new combat knife flashing. My sisters burst from their alcoves, cutting off Castilian's escape and accounting for the rest of them. The killing did not last long. After a few seconds, the 12 guards were lying at our feet, their armour sliced open with precise knife wounds, their blood slowly pooling under awkwardly twisted limbs. Castilian was held in place, and I advanced on her, drawing out my translexa as I came. "Where is Slist?" it told her. She was terrified. Her fat face wobbled with fear, and a sheen of sweat broke out under a heavily made-up forehead. "Abomination!" she hissed. "You dare profane this place!" I came in closer, placing my knife against her stomach. It pleased me to think how much she must have been hating this, forced into close proximity to one of our benighted, god-cursed kind. "Where is Slist?" the translexa repeated. Her features hardened. "You cannot make me talk. I die first." Many of the Ecclesiarchy's warriors would indeed have done that. Their fervour made the best of them incorruptible, capable of withstanding the most stringent forms of agony in order to keep their secrets. Though I detested such souls, I could have a certain measure of respect for them. Castilian, however, was not one of these. That was why we had selected her. The next thoughtmark gesture was a special one, a mark of intimidation that caused physical pain, addling the senses and generating a burst of fear in even the staunchest of unmodified spirits. "Where is Slist?" Her eyes went wide. "No," she blurted, shivering uncontrollably. "No, no." That was pathetic, quicker than I had expected. Still, I judged that she was sincere in her desperation to escape us, so I lowered my head towards hers, ready to give her another shock if needed. She told me where he was. I didn't recognize the location she gave me, but could easily find out where it lay. I pulled back. "But it will do you no good," she spat, something like defiance returning. "The orders have been given. He won't be long. You'll die before getting within a kilometer of him." It was always intriguing to see the point at which a human's fear of us tipped over into fury. I wondered why she had even told us the truth, if she had not wished to be spared by us. Perhaps she had done so out of spite, believing that we would find our own deaths in a futile attempt to reach our target. "You are filth," she cried. "You are devils.
You will be hunted. You will be...
I silenced her with a swift pull of the knife across her throat, taking more than a little satisfaction in the way the edge sliced through those thick lines of pearls. Her body crumpled to the floor, dropped heavily by my sister's. Rover looked at me.
You believe her?
I reached down for the hem of her robe and cleaned my blade carefully. I had only just taken ownership of it, so felt obliged to look after it. In any case, it would be in use again soon. I do, I signed. Be joyful, my sisters. Now it begins.
Chapter 19. Jack. The agreement lasted just about as long as I expected to, which is to say, almost no time at all. I had found the summit arranged by Valoris to be an intriguing event, not least due to the way it ruthlessly exposed all the faults that had dogged us for so long. The Captain General was a High Lord, but he was only able to summon a small section of the Council to join him when he wished it. Those who had attended were mostly opposed to what we all believed in, which further exposed its irrelevance. And once we began, his attempts to remain aloof from the actual meat of the debate became increasingly painful to witness. I could appreciate the difficulty of his position. The custodians were not used to involving themselves directly in politics, and they placed great store on being above the grubby business of power grabs. He had called the meeting, I suspect, out of exasperation, but when the time came, he still resisted bringing his golden fist down and imposing the order we all craved. Why was this? It couldn't be weakness. No sane person would ever accuse Trajan Valoris of that. But it was almost certainly an exaggerated importance placed on the letter of the Lex. They were supposed to be impartial in all matters that did not directly impinge on the security of the throne. Unless and until the political crisis threatened the palace itself, they would act as they had been doing all along, allowing others to take the initiative, uttering soothing words here and there, and ultimately abdicating responsibility. I watched Phaedix intently, of course. His conduct, to be frank, had chilled me. He had been enjoying himself, making life as uncomfortable as possible for Roscavler, showing up a Shariel for the brute he was, even having the nerve to provoke Moloch a little. He, of all of us, had been the most assured, as if everything was unfolding just as he wished it to be. Knowing what I knew of him, this made me deeply uncomfortable. Our efforts to uncover more information on his intentions and capabilities had been thwarted across the board. He was simply too careful and too dangerous for us to get close. To make matters worse, soon after the summit had broken up, reports of clashes between Garadon's and Moloch's forces began to come in. The very idea that I, an official within the hierarchy, might be able to somehow adjudicate between these forces was laughable. The custodians, of course, were diligent and timely with their sharing of data. We soon knew everything about their proposed movements and strategy, which made it easy to gain a picture of their operations. They were spread thin, as you would expect, maintaining a policy of precision strikes against rumoured splintered activity. They went in swiftly, performed their task with a minimum of fuss, and then withdrew again without fanfare. That was efficient, and it was useful, but it also meant that their role was kept largely out of the public gaze. The wider citizenry could have had almost no idea that they were even active. Garadon's forces were more grudging with us, being used to working on their own and having little experience of civilian oversight. Still, they did their best, seconding Lieutenant Hessler to my departmento and issuing bulletins from time to time. It was through these reports that we learned of the armed encounters with their cousins in the field. If the Imperial Fists were to be believed, the Minotaurs were landing in ever greater numbers, and their strategy was baffling. One day they might coordinate tolerably well, combining forces to destroy known splintered dens. Another day, they would go silent and pursue their own targets, causing havoc in high population hives. On yet another day, they might appear to be actively frustrating the Imperial Fists, blocking their progress, or getting in ahead of them and laying waste to valuable sites of evidence. The Minotaurs themselves, of course, gave us nothing of value. They sent a lone warrior named Zojek to act as Hessler's opposite number, but he was virtually silent and served mostly to put the fear of the throne into my long-suffering staff. It could not last long, and, sure enough, it didn't. I awoke from a short and overdue sleep period to hear alarms ringing through my fortress. I hurriedly dressed and pulled myself from my chamber, sending urgent queries to Mordecai. He replied tersely.
"Signals chamber. Get here swiftly, if you may."
Before I reached his position, I already had an inkling what I might find. I was broadly corrected, although I could not have been prepared for the violence of it. I had seen Space Marines fighting before, and even witnessed part of the great battle of the Lion's Gate before my nerve had failed. That had, however, been at distance, and the horror of the night meant that my memories of it were fragmentary. I had never seen them fight up close. Now that I have done, I firmly wish never to do so again. By the time I reached our signals chamber, I found a scene of absolute destruction. My staff had mostly fled, leaving behind a large room filled with flying wreckage. In the midst of it all, Hessler and Zojek were hammering away at one another as if the world had ended and they were the last ones standing. The violence of it was both breathtaking and infuriating. They had destroyed much of my valuable equipment already, and with every slam of clenched fists or head-down shoulder charge, more of it was demolished. There was no question of me or anyone else intervening. We could only watch as their incredible power was turned on one another in a maddening, futile brawl. It is only when you see what a Space Marine can do when they unshackle themselves that you begin to appreciate the control they must exert at all other times. Once given their head, they are like forces of nature, unique fusions of flesh and mechanics, veritable engines of annihilation. Everything about them, the vox growls and bellows, the burnt metal stench, the speed and momentum of their movements, the lethal combination of raw energy and spatial intelligence, was designed to shock and intimidate. Even amid my horror, I could detect subtle differences between the two of them. Zojek was fighting in a wild, berserk rage, flinging clenched gauntlets at his opponent in flurries. When those blows connected, they were absolutely ferocious, denting and cracking the ceramite. Hessler fought back in the way I might have expected of one of the Emperor's finest, contained, less flamboyant, but still quite deadly. The two of them smashed through a cogitator stand, reducing it to slivers of spinning metal, trading more bone-breaking blows before lurching across an already battered console surface and grappling in close. I do not know what would have happened if the custodian Onus had not turned up when he did. Perhaps they would have killed one another. In the event, Onus strode right into the heart of it. He was almost a head taller than both and, unlike them, had activated his power weapon. With a speed and a skill that was at least the match of theirs, he managed to interpose himself between them, angling his guardian's spear in such a way that it blocked a crunching two-fisted strike from Zojek. Hessler broke free then, staggering clear from the rampaging Minotaur, his breathing ragged. For a moment, I thought Zojek would go after the custodian, so consumed was he by his battle rage. In the event, not even he was insane enough for that. He stood down. He looked at me, then at Hessler. A metallic laugh slipped from his bronze vox grill. Then he stalked off, stamping through the wreckage of my machines. None attempted to stay him, and my menials shrank back as he trudged close. He walked with a pronounced limp, and his armor bore many signs of surface damage, but the projection of terror was still acute.
"What is this?"
I demanded, picking my way through the detritus and attempting to salvage just a little something of my dignity. Hessler removed his helm. His face was badly bruised, and blood ran down from his temple where the ceramite had been driven in. Anger flashed in his eyes.
"They broke the pact,"
he snarled, ignoring Onus and speaking to me.
"It was worthless from the start, and now they have blood on their hands."
Mordecai came to join me, and my menials gingerly began to creep forward to see what still remained.
"What do you mean?"
I asked. Hessler still bristled with fury. Even though not directed at me, it was difficult to remain calm in the face of.
"They have obstructed. They have lied. And we bore it all. Now they dare to cross us. We lost two out in the Gedeon spires when we pressed our right to investigate a kill site. I came to demand restitution. He did not give me any."
Two space marines killed. That was a significant escalation, and a serious loss to sustain for an already battle-ravaged company.
"What of Captain Garadon?" I asked.
"He is not in the mood for any further games,"
Hessler said.
"He will demand material vengeance if Moloch does nothing."
"Tell him to wait," I begged. "Just a little longer. When news of this reaches Valoris..."
Hessler laughed.
"Valoris will do what, exactly? Call another summit?"
He spat bloodily onto the ground and maglocked his helm.
"I warn you, Chancellor. We stand on the precipice now. This is our world. If you force us to fight for it against any foe, however numerous, we will do it."
I knew that to be true. They had already showed considerable restraint, but clearly their patience was fast running out.
"I will do what I can,"
I told him, trying to make him see that I was an ally. He looked at me. I feel sure he did not mean to, but at that moment it felt as if he was staring down at a something totally irrelevant, an irritant that had to be borne, but which meant nothing compared to the distasteful business that lay ahead and would have to be addressed soon.
"You do that, Chancellor,"
he said, turning to leave.
"But do not take too long. I tell you truly now, the reckoning is close at hand."
He was right. Everything seemed to be spiraling out of kilter now, and in ways that only portended badly. Leaving my staff to do what they could to restore the signals chamber, I withdrew to consult with Mordecai.
"Valoris should never have expected us to manage them,"
he muttered, sitting heavily. That was surely right, but did us no good to dwell on. "This will drag us into civil war," I said. "We must return to our first instincts." I had become concerned about Perith, the only one of the High Lords to have responded in any positive manner to my entreaties. I knew that she had managed to find significant forces, and I knew that a fleet had entered orbit and received clearance for landings. From what I understood, the numbers promised to be the most decisive element of all. If we were looking at division-level strength, possibly with heavy air support and the capability to lift armor into position, that might eclipse even the combined heft of the Adeptus Astartes, making their feuding irrelevant. I wished to cut them out, now. I wished to make Moloch and Garadon as irrelevant as I had been in my own fortress. And yet, we still had no details, and could only speculate as to when the quiet road might finally live up to its early promise.
"Protocol be damned," I said. "Where is she now?"
Mordecai raised an eyebrow.
"Are you sure, Lord?"
"She has been too quiet," I muttered, making the connection with our intelligence data feed. "And for too long." Perith was in her citadel, according to our observation network. That was close by, and I could be there within the hour. In normal times, I would never have presumed to demand an audience at such notice. but things had reached such a pass that I needed clarity without further delay.
"Tell them I'm coming," I ordered Mordecai, reaching for my chain of office. "Tell them I won't be taking no for an answer, and tell them that if I fail to gain entry, I'll enact a level 4 civil emergency and activate the custodians to break down the doors."
Doing such a thing was far beyond my power, of course. I had sent a signal, though, and I trusted that whoever was on the other end of the comlink would appreciate my commitment. Once airborne, and as the giant ouse-like rock face of the naval headquarters swelled in my flyer's forward scopes, I considered the many unwelcome reasons why Perith might have remained silent. From his conduct at the summit, Ashariel had clearly known just what my role in all this had been. Phaedix, too, had behaved with a particular silky arrogance, as if all had already been taken care of, and he need no longer worry about the actions of any other faction. It was rare for a High Lord to be eliminated by another overtly, but hardly without precedent. What if Perith's growing influence over events had proved too much for her rivals? What if the divisions in the Council were such that resorting to violence had become the default response, masked by the disorder in all other quarters? What if that was why she had not answered my repeated communications? By the time this had occurred to me, it was too late to go back. My flyer was picked up by the security cordon, and I was guided into the receiving hangars. Once inside, I was greeted with the usual courtesies and ushered towards the High Lord's private rooms. It was all very polished, very polite, just as it had been on the Excelsis Crua, but I could not shake the feeling, which only grew with every step I took, that something here was very wrong. Soon I stood in an antechamber, and my escorts, having offered me a drink, which I declined, withdrew back into their warrens of subsidiary rooms and counting halls. I found myself alone in a wide, real-wood-panelled space, the walls lined with images of line battleships, the tabletops containing what looked like gold models of famous vessels. My heart was pounding. My palms began to sweat. Eventually, the doors before me opened, and I saw, with considerable relief, Perith sitting at her desk. She rose to greet me, smiling warmly. I tried not to make my agitation obvious and took a deep, steadying breath. My nerves were frayed. I was beginning to let fantasy get the better of me. I found that I regretted turning down that drink and walked stiffly across the threshold to greet the Lord High Admiral.
"Chancellor," she said, "this is unexpected. What was all that nonsense about custodians?"
"Forgive me," I said. "It has been so hard to reach you. I had begun to worry a little. These are dangerous times." Perith laughed.
"They are indeed," she said, closing the doors. "Though, as you see, I'm very much intact. It has not been easy organizing what had to be organized. And yet, as you rightly said, it had to be done. That is the lesson, I think. With determination, all things may be achieved."
"The Adeptus Astartes have been, as predicted, unmanageable," I said. "We need these forces now, something to neutralize our requirement for them."
"Be reassured," she said, walking back towards her desk. "We have them. The carriers are in position and ready to deploy."
As she spoke, she activated a schematic, which hung between us as a translucent rectangular gauze. I looked at the figures glowing there and saw that she was not exaggerating. The numbers were staggering.
"You were quite correct, Chancellor. Gilliman was remiss to leave his home world so underdefended. The time has come for decisive action. An order for Planet 4 will be made shortly, just as soon as I am back on the bridge of the Crua."
It was then that I noticed the militarum elements among the lists.